And be brutally honest. That probably is the only bit of advice. Be brutally honest with yourself. Because if you're not, you're going to find yourself in trouble. Because if your responsibility is to look after other people, but you're going there because you're severely psychologically damaged and burnt out, that isn't going to work.
Welcome. I am Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and I am your host on this edition of the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. Our guest tonight is Dr. Barry McKenna, and we are going to discuss the challenges, opportunities, adventures, revelations, and pitfalls of an expedition to kayak the Inside Passage for charity. And for those of you who are unclear on what the Inside Passage is, it's from just south of Seattle all the way along the coast of the U.S., through the coast of Canada up into Alaska. And I first met Barry at the World Extreme Medicine event in Edinburgh years ago at a K-Lead party. We hit it off and we have been friends ever since. And if you have never attended a K-Lead, I suggest that you add that to your life goals list. Barry lived in Northern Ireland and went to school in Belfast in the 1970s and 80s. He studied aero engineering at Bristol University in 1986 to 1989, sponsored by the military. He survived Guillain-Barré syndrome in 1987. He recovered from that and went to officer training at Sandhurst in 1989 and 1990, and then spent some time in the military. He received ultimately a medical discharge and went to work for British Aerospace as an aerodynamicist. He then took redundancy and went to medical school, ED and GP, since qualifying in 1997. And he and I both got off shift today. And his hobbies include kayaking, of course, cold water swimming, anything outdoors, especially time with his wife. And so, Barry, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Lovely to see you.
Nice to see you, too. And so I asked you to join me today to discuss the project, the Kayak the Inside Passage project. So tell me more about this project and how it was conceived.
Well, it was originally conceived by two of the team members back pre-COVID, and it was originally a plan to kayak the Amazon from source to estuary. COVID delayed that by a year, and then the big problem was nobody could get insurance to kayak the Amazon because it had just become too dangerous because of drug trafficking and the risk of kidnapping or getting shot. So most of the guys on the trip are ex-military and have been injured, and they've had quite enough of being shot, and their track record for that is not particularly good. So they decided they would look at other options. So they looked at lots of other options and eventually settled on kayaking the Inside Passage, which, as you said, is, you know, that beautiful sort of stretch of fjordland from Washington State up to Alaska. That was agreed about a year and a half, 2 years before I joined the team, which was 2 years ago. So it was already in motion when I joined the team, and they already had some plans already in place for it.
Wonderful, wonderful. What made you want to go on this journey? What's your why?
Initially, I didn't really know. I got a phone call from Rich Wayne Hobson from WEM, who had been asked to have a look at being the medic on the team. And he had a look at it and realized it was quite a commitment in terms of kayaking. And he looked at the time involved and the distances, et cetera, and thought, no, not for me. But says, I think I know somebody who might be interested. So he gave me a call and said, look, have a chat with these guys and see if you're interested in doing it. And, you know, like many of the things you do in life, you don't really have true insight into why you're getting drawn towards it. And I just chatted to some of the guys about what they were doing. It seemed interesting. So I went along and met them one weekend, and I was a little bit surprised considering they'd been kayaking for so long. I thought, oh, their technique isn't brilliant. So, you know, I've got a lot of experience in flat water kayaking. So it's kayaking in a straight line for a long time, up to 125 mile races. So I spent the whole weekend teaching them how to kayak and getting their technique correct. And through doing that, you get to know the guys. And I thought, I like these guys. They're really easy to teach, really easy to engage with. And it was just nice being back in that environment. I really enjoyed that. I didn't really question why I was doing that. And I don't think I really asked myself that question properly until I was out there. And, you know, you're actually on the trip. You're thinking, why have I done this? Because you don't really know what your objectives are. And it's one of the things I was thinking about for talks on looking at medical planning documents. You're absolutely right. You need to look at why you're doing something before you do it. You know, what is your objective? Is your objective financial? I mean, highly unlikely when it comes to medical support for, unless it's something to do with television or films, you know, the financial remuneration from it is negligible. Usually you have to pay to go on these things rather than be paid. So, but you know, if it's financial, yes, you're going to be sorely disappointed. The other objectives could be that you're doing it for professional reasons. So, if you're considerably younger than me, you may be doing it for CV or, professional development purposes. And that may be your goal, which may balance out against your financial rewards or financial costs. And the other bit, which was probably a lot to do with me, is I was actually quite desperate to go by the end of it. And I think I just didn't have the, not only the insight to recognize why I was doing it, I didn't have the insight to recognize that I was becoming burnt out. And I just didn't recognize that. And I was searching for something else. And this was just the perfect sort of socially acceptable way of switching the computer off and switching it on again. And then seeing what came back. Yeah, a reboot, and just see what came back out. And as my wife said, you know, it would be disappointing if you came back exactly the same person. I mean, it's the whole point of going in these things. You're looking for some personal change from it. Otherwise, what's the point in doing it? And that's absolutely.
You
know, it doesn't matter whether it's positive or negative. If you haven't learnt anything from it, then what was the point? I hadn't recognized myself the sort of hyper nature of which I was desperate for this trip to happen and was doing everything I could to make it happen because I needed that to reboot myself. Yeah, just to decompress and have a look and see who this person was or who had this person become.
And it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? That it just gives you perspective, and then the things that were bothering you maybe don't bother you as much when you get back, and you have a different perspective, and you're able to approach people with that. Like I find that some of these adventures and challenges, and even the worst of times adventures, I come back more patient and more calm and just happy to be here. And so I know you've kayaked very long distances before, but have you ever done anything quite like this before?
No, nothing to this extent in terms of this level of expedition, because most of the things I've done have been very short and sharp sort of ultra races. As a competitor, it is very different doing it as the medic on the trip, because the difficulty with that is you have to be as physically capable as anybody else. You have to have the same administrative skills in the field as everybody else. Yet you have to be available for everybody else for timely consultations. You know, when somebody is feeling low, what if that's at a point where you're feeling low or you're not particularly well or you've got a sore shoulder? You know, and you've you've got to balance that and think about that before you go. So I think a lot of these things, it's not just a personal challenge, it's a professional challenge as well, because you've got, if you're embedded in a team, it's very different to being a medic at a base camp. So if you're the medic that is on a polar trip and you're actually pulling a sled the same as the other guys, or if you're kayaking with the other guys, it's very different to being a medic on a base camp, because you're not, you may not be going up that mountain with those guys and coming back down with them. You're going to be treating them when they come back down. So there are a couple of things that are good and bad about that. You're obviously, the good things if you're at a base camp is that you're prepared, you have better equipment because you don't have to carry it with you, and you're less likely to be physically, emotionally degraded as a result of doing the same activities that everybody else is. The difficulty sometimes is it can be a them and us, and it's your reputation. So you can see it in the military sometimes, where there's different reputations for certain types of medic depending on what type of training they've done. So SF medics will, special forces medics will be treated very differently to medics in other units, because they have gone through the same training that the other special forces soldiers have done. So they're considered a soldier with an extra skill. So if you're on a polar trip or you're on a trip like this, you're a kayaker with an extra skill. You're there, you're one of their mates, but you've got an extra skill. You're the doc. And that, I could see that developing. There were one or two guys who always called me doc, but as the trip went on, that they started to drop that and they would call you Barry. So you could see that at the beginning you were seeing the doc. You had a professional capacity and they saw you as a professional. But by the end of it, you were their friend, you're their colleague, but you had this extra skill. The same way as somebody who's the navigator or the safety officer or the, you know, the media guy. You know, everybody was principally a kayaker, but you had an extra skill.
I love that. That is very well put. So you had to have had to ship so much gear. I mean, kayaks are not a small item to get from point A to point B. So all the gear and all the supplies. Tell me more about the planning and the logistics that went into getting all of the gear there for yourselves.
Well, as you mentioned before, medicine, I would say I was an engineer, so I just love planning for things and logistics. Doing a good spreadsheet, getting a good list done for things, and lots of what if questions. So I was a very unhappy man. I was a very unhappy man because there isn't a good list or a good template for a medical planning document. So I thought, I'll speak to Nikki McCleary about this from WEM and I'll get pointed in the right direction. And Nikki agreed there isn't a decent planning template, but she showed me one that she had used as part of her MSc dissertation. So we sat down and went through this and actually came up with a decent template for looking at producing a very workable, not just a theoretical, but a workable medical planning document for an expedition. And we could see that there wasn't anything like that on the internet. And I knew that at some point the charity were going to ask for it and the insurers would ask for it. So we put a lot of thought into it, and it was a pretty hefty document, probably about 60 pages, with lots of information looking at all the aspects of the expedition from start to finish, and all sort of emergency SOPs, etc. And we'll actually present some of that and do workshops on it at the WEM conference this year.
I will try to be there for that. Yes.
Lovely. It's great to come up with a list, but as you said, one of the problems is, so if you come up with a list of this is what we need to do and this is the equipment we need to do it, How do you squeeze it into an 18-foot boat, which only has a certain amount of space for medical equipment? And it's a very narrow kayak as well. Plus, you have to carry it with you. So there's a weight and space sort of barrier to anything you decide to do. So yeah, I had to identify because I have to carry the same kit as everybody else. So, I've got to carry the same food, the same clothes, the same safety equipment, same amount of water as well as squeezing in all my medical kit. So you did have to become quite inventive. So I've documented every aspect of where I put the kit and how I stored it in a waterproof format and laid it out in such a way that if there was an emergency, that it was stored in a workable and usable format. Because there was elective kit that you took, which is stuff that you didn't really need to use very often. Or if you did, it would be in an organized fashion. That was in front of my pedals in the cockpit. Any emergency equipment, such as adrenaline injections, and I used buccal midazolam because if anybody had a seizure, there's one of the guys who did have epilepsy from gunshot wounds to the head. If he did seize, it would be a seizure on the water with a dry suit on. So you can't use rectal diazepam. So I carried buccal midazolam, which I could just pull out and immediately squirt it up into his gum. And fortunately we didn't have to use it. Yeah. So you had to think through things like that. And that was easily accessible gear. And then there was an emergency bag set up in two ways in the rear hatch, which would only be used if we had to get somebody to land. Now, interestingly, in one of our training days, we did have a guest instructor with us who actually lost consciousness on the water when we were in the UK and in training in really cold weather in January. It was, yeah, probably about January time of this year. So he went unconscious, upside down in the water. So we had to rescue him, bring him back out, get him to land, and we actually had a complete reenactment of our emergency situation and all the equipment that I had with us, and it worked perfectly. So from little things like you had a packable stretcher this size that the size of your fist that you unfold, four guys can immediately carry the guy up to you. You have an emergency bivvy and all the safety equipment that you need to assess the person and treat them. And that worked brilliantly. So we had a dry run of everything, and the guy was absolutely fine. He didn't have any sequelae from his injuries, so it worked perfectly. So that gave the guys a lot of confidence that what we were doing would work, and it was a very good dry run of what we thought was the right way to lay out the equipment. So yeah, that worked perfectly, but a lot of time and effort went in to thinking of that, and it's certainly something we want to share with the rest of the medical community.
Oh, I can't wait to learn more about that. I mean, and just de deploying it quickly, like you said, is just it's a life and death thing. Because you're not just on the water up there; you're in the North Pacific. It's freezing. That it's in the Bering Sea. Like it
Yes.
is not just water. Like that water is unforgiving. I've been. Did you guys go swimming in it? Did you do polar plunges?
Yeah, well, a few of us did.
Sorry.
Taff, one of the guys who lives near here, he's quite a keen open water swimmer, and I would as well. So a few of us went swimming, but three of the guys are South Africans, so I think if the water's below 20 degrees, they think that's cold. So up in Alaska, places like that, and especially some of the channels where the water was coming through very quickly, it would be around 6, 7 degrees, and yeah, you would just jump in, but you wouldn't be in it for very long. But it's certainly very refreshing
No.
after
Yeah,
days
it's the
paddling.
temperature of melted ice.
Yep.
It's freshly melted ice.
Oh, we didn't
But
go into that.
oh.
That water is absolutely brutal, and actually, you come out dirtier than you went in, because the glacial meltwater has lots of moraine in it, so it's actually like a really grey colour, and you do actually come out dirtier than you went in. It's really
Yeah.
filthy water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
N
But a
not
wonderful
yeah,
experience.
not as refreshing.
Nope,
For
nope.
sure. Nope. So you guys had a COVID delay as well. So when was this supposed to originally happen? There's, so many things were affected by that.
The original trip, the Amazon trip, was meant to happen back in 2019, no, 2018, 2019. Then we had the delay 21, 22 because of COVID and because of financial logistics. So one of the things that happened in 22 was that shipping costs for containers to the West Coast of America went from $5,000 to $18,000-$20,000. So it just made the trip financially unviable. So we had to delay it to 2023, which gave me a bit more time to sort out sabbatical cover, getting people to
So
cover
did they
my work
getting
while they're
coverage?
away.
Because yeah, it's not like your patients just It's not just like your patients don't need you anymore. It's just you
Nope.
still have to make sure all of your people are taken care of. So did the team change at all because of the change in the timeline?
The team was reasonably well fixed for about 18 months before the trip, so it gave enough time for all the pre-preparation planning and training, which was actually part of the medical planning document. So you had to make sure that everybody was physically and medically okay to go. And one of the interesting things about this is everybody, and it's different from medical assessment for people on other trips. If you look at this trip, one of the biggest concerns was the risk of what type of physiology does somebody have. So if you think of about three main types of physiology, there are people who improve by doing bursts of training and then they need rest periods. And then there are people who, if you do continuous physical exercise, they will degrade and they will need time out. And then there are other types of people who do continuous physical exercise and can maintain that and improve rather than degrade. Now, because of the training background and the military background of everybody in this team, I knew that they were all the third type. In other words, they were all the physiology who can cope with sustained physical exertion because they're all either ex-military, already kayak guide, or people who have rowed the Atlantic. So if you've done those things, you've already pre-selected yourself as somebody who can do 30 plus days of exercise constantly without degradation. So we already knew, and that's a really important point about establishing the team. So one of the really difficult things would be if you suddenly had somebody come in at the end in something like this, and you think, are you having to take this person because you need an extra bum on a seat? But if you do that, you could potentially bring in somebody who would disrupt the physiology of the team and would need longer rest periods, recovery periods, than everybody else would. So.
And so we talked about work, and how difficult was it to get with the program, so to speak, to decompress from society and civilization and your responsibilities and the daily work grind? How long did that take, and how difficult was that?
Again, depends on your objectives. You can never really tell at the time. Retrospectively, I think it possibly took me 5 to 6 weeks to actually start switching off and being able to be yourself rather than be I don't know, if you're being a doctor on the trip or what. It's one of the guys, he would say things to me. I said, look, okay to be you, just be Barry. And it is very difficult. And I think again it goes back to your objectives, and you sometimes have to be clear with yourself of why you're going on a trip like this. And if you've got multiple goals, so if it's I just want to complete the expedition, or I want to prove that I'm a good team member, or I want something in my CV, or are you trying to find out who you are and if you actually quite like yourself, or You want to find out something more about yourself. If you don't lay out those objectives before you go, you won't actually know whether you've achieved anything or whether you need to change anything along the way to change direction. And certainly there was a bit of a paradigm shift with me at certain points where I had to sit back and say, actually, the way you're dealing with certain things here isn't good, and you need to change that, because you're dealing with things in the way you normally would, which is to be very engaged and to be directional and to be functional. Whereas in actual fact, sometimes the best thing to do is lay down boundaries for yourself and extract yourself and learn when to say no to things rather than constantly trying to fix everything. Because if people or things don't want to be fixed, then all you're doing is just setting yourself up for failure.
That is the truth. That is the truth. And along those lines, I mean, a trip like this, like weeks in the wilderness, really changes us. And so what did you feel were some of the interpersonal and personal changes you noticed in yourself and in others during the trip?
I think, well, the most noticeable thing was that physically there wasn't much change. So I think we were very protected by that, because I think you can certainly have big personal changes if you're physically exhausted or if you are struggling with the admin side of it. I think most of us didn't find it too physically demanding, nor did we find that idea of living in the field much of a problem. And that's, again, because of background, we actually quite liked it. I think, you know, especially if your physical changes in something like this, or you actually felt better than you do in normal life. I had no headaches, no migraines. My eyesight got better. I had no lower back pain. I had no hip pain. My knees felt great. I was sleeping in the tent for 67 days. And by the end of it, I felt absolutely fantastic. And so physically, you're getting a bit of a bonus there. Now, what that says about our current lifestyle is incredible, that it's actually much better physically to live in a tent and to kayak for 6 to 8 hours a day than it is to work in, you know, for me, I use a ball to sit on at work, and I occasionally use my standing desk, and I try to do as much as I can, you know, doing press-ups in between patients and things, yet still I feel mentally and physically exhausted. So physically, if you feel better and you're bouncing out of bed in the morning, you realize actually certain things about yourself. You know, I got a lot of feedback from the guys that I insufferable in the morning because of my enthusiasm and happiness, and that is something that has to stop, they said.
This is why we're friends.
They said annoyingly happy in the morning, talkative and enthusiastic, but I think annoyingly happy in the morning was one feedback. Yep, for people. Just yep. Don't talk to me, they would say. Just do not talk to me yet, I'm not ready. The main things I learned about myself was that, you know, when you're constantly trying to fix things or you're trying to make things better, usually it's a deflection and you're trying to do it because you're not quite happy with something in yourself. And at some point you're going to have to face that and address it. And I had to, at some point, I just had to go a little bit quiet and figure out why I didn't really love myself. And that's a tricky one to do. And, you know, what is that negative internal dialogue that you get? And it's louder in some people than it is in another, that's constantly telling you you're not, or, you know, just that little voice that you hear in the back of your head that's quite unpleasant. So you do lots of things to stop that voice or make it shut up a little bit, or certainly be quieter. You turn down the volume on it, But when you're sort of week 7 or week 8 into a trip like that, you're given the space to actually listen to that voice, and you have to make a choice about where it's coming from and what's it about. And in actual fact, you just have to face up and work out that actually stop deflecting and doing what most of us do as medics, which is proxy mend yourself by helping others. At some point, you're going to have to sort out what's going on inside your own head. And that's a difficult thing to do, but I had a wonderful opportunity to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose now I need to
Well,
say what those changes
switching
were.
gears a little bit, I mean, you did. You open yourself up to have that conversation with the voice in your head that can make you miserable at times, and that tells you, somebody else is smarter, or somebody else should have this opportunity, or whatever it is that it says to you. No, I think that's a huge change, is being able to sort of face that voice and say, "Hey, we need to have a talk, and we're going to work this out." I hope. Do you love yourself now?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely a lot happier. I think the amazing thing is if you're honest about these things and you chat about it, you realize that the people you're on the trip to help and look after, they're so happy and confident in your ability to do that that it actually becomes reciprocated and they start helping you. And was a shift throughout the trip that, at many points they were talking to me and helping me understand lots of things about my background and why I do the things I do and why I say the things I do and why I feel the way I do. And they could recognize it because they'd been watching it. They'd been watching it for weeks. And they could see it. And if you're receptive enough for that and not do the classic thing that will wind up medics is to say, if a patient says yes but to you, and it's very easy to say yes but to people if they're giving you really good advice and if it's meant well, then you should listen to it and you should receive it. It's your choice as to what you want to do with it. But yeah, I'm incredibly indebted to the guys who would just be paddling along. And kayaking is like it's like EMDR in that respect, that because you're getting bilateral stimulation as you're paddling, it keeps you in the present moment. So you can talk about emotive things without being drawn back into that emotive time because you're still here and now, because you're getting that bilateral stimulation and you need to concentrate on what you're doing at that time, but not completely concentrate. It's a rhythmical motion that you're doing. And it doesn't matter whether that's kayaking, swimming, running, cycling. It's you're using your body symmetrically, and that is something that you can sustain. And that's no different to EMDR. It's no different to, the buzzers that you get from, if the therapist was using buzzers. It's exactly the same thing. And it's all about keeping the person in the today while they talk about things that are emotionally charged. And it stops you being drawn back into that time where it's difficult to talk about those things. So normally what people will do is either become emotionally overwhelmed or switch off. So there's a cutout switch that we have in our heads that will stop us going back to that because it's just too uncomfortable to go back there. So you don't, so you never deal with it. So you just set up this sort of little contraflow that you constantly do in a little detour that you do throughout your life with everything. And people do it with, they do it in work, they do it in relationships. So as soon as a relationship gets a little bit difficult, they're out. And they just recreate this cycle. And it's a real privilege to have people who who care about you to talk about those things and give you the space to do it and to have the time to do it, because that's the main thing. We don't have the time or the environment, or do we? Have we surrounded ourselves with people who care enough about you and are honest enough to guide you through that process in a safe way? And I was very lucky that I had that, and it was
brilliant.
It would have been crazy not to take advantage of it.
Lovely, I love that. And so I understand there were some logistics initially that pushed back the timeline, and the team was hoping to make up the time because everybody has lives and patients we have to get back to. We talked about that, families, work. Now, some of the team had to leave early, and I can only imagine that this was an incredibly tough decision. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, again, it goes back to objectives, Sarah, and whether it's personal objectives. If we look at, makes me think back to some of your lectures, we all have a difficult relationship with failure and not achieving something. And I always thought one of my principal goals in this trip was to complete the expedition. And that my second one was to be a sociable and functional team member. And I thought the third one was to try and come back a better me. In actual fact, those objectives inverted. So what do we mean by completing the expedition? If, polar trips and mountain trips are much more goal oriented in that respect, because there's a clear goal that if you achieve, you either achieve it or you don't. But some trips have achieved the ultimate goal, but the team come back broken, disillusioned. We made a decision to finish at the point we did, because we had to come back to life. It was a joint decision made by a number of us. Yet I thought it would be really difficult to not complete, but in actual fact, we do think that we completed the expedition. Just the expedition didn't complete its goal. We completed the expedition because we sort of achieved everything we wanted to achieve. It's the expedition didn't achieve its goal. And that's okay. In the same way as, you could be on an expedition to Everest. You might not make it up Everest, but, the expedition could have been a complete success apart from that point. There's some expeditions that probably made it up Everest, but, those people didn't achieve anything personally or in terms of their professional development. So that was a bit of an eye opener for me, that it didn't hit me as hard as I did, because I was happier with the achievement of working out more about myself and actually being very happy as a team member, and very happy living as a vagrant in a tent and packing all my personal belongings into a boat in the morning and kayaking off to another camping spot. It was simplistic but beautiful, and it became a routine, and you become unforgiving and unapologetic about your own lifestyle. My craving for routine, I thought, well, some of the guys asked about it, and why do you have to do this? And you think, well, you're at school, then you join the military, then you go to university, then you work in engineering, and then you go to medicine, all of those are bounded by routine boundaries, by conditions, by regulations. And, I just fitted a similar template around my day out there, but it became softer as time went on. But you just you sort of realize why you're the sort of person you are, and you either have to accept that or continue being confused. But yeah, I was quite happy to work out who I was, and I was okay with finishing when we did, even though there was still a few hundred kilometers left to go. You had to just make a decision. Yeah, and
I can
five
see
has made
that.
that
I mean, you know
decision.
what? Yeah. And you know I never stand on top of anything I've ever climbed on purpose. Sometimes it's a safety decision, sometimes it's just because I don't and I never have. And now I'm afraid that if I do, something bad will happen because I'm extremely superstitious. And so it's always the journey, not the destination for me. So I have incredible respect for that. And I know it was a tough decision to make, but I applaud it. I applaud it.
Thank you.
So what were the biggest challenges you faced, like medically speaking, I guess, at least. We've talked about some of the logistical challenges, but what was the biggest challenge you faced medically out there? Because there it's fraught with potential, but sometimes it doesn't,
It
sometimes it's
is.
like a sore throat when I was expecting a tourniquet.
The trauma kit wasn't opened, which is a great thing to happen, isn't it? We did have a sore throat, and I did give some antibiotics for it because I thought, well, I have them, I might as well use them. We had a splinter in a finger. We had a sore shoulder. We had somebody who caught his hand on the tree and had a little cut on the palm of his hand. So we had some pretty serious injuries, Sarah, and we dealt with them all admirably. Actually, somebody did get a little bit of an infection in a bit of intertrigo, from being in wetsuit boots the whole time. So it was medically tough, and I was starting to switch off until the ferry home. And then I was in the restaurant one evening on the ferry back, and so this is a US Alaskan ferry in Canadian waters with a mixture of international passengers on it, and we had an American guy behind us who was, morbidly obese, and he stood up after eating his meal and just keeled over and lost consciousness. So I assessed him. We got him down to sick bay, and it looked as if he was hemodynamically unstable, looked as if he had had a PE, and he had had a knee replacement the year before and had a post-op PE, but had stopped his DOAC 1 month ago because he had been on holiday in Alaska and hadn't bothered to get any more. So I was saying, look, I think we need to medevac this guy. And it was, 8 o'clock at night by this point. And I was saying, well, look, US citizen, Canadian waters, I don't have any indemnity in for this, and you probably need to chat to another doctor. So I had a chat to the US doctors who covered the ferry, and they said, yeah, medevac him immediately. So I went up to the bridge, spoke to the captain, and he put us through to Victoria Traffic, who sort of control Canadian waters along in between Vancouver and the mainland, Vancouver Island and the mainland, coming down towards the Johnston Strait. And by that point, we were sort of northern end up sort of Port Hardy, Port McNeill, and we're getting towards Nanaimo, and then it would be down towards Victoria itself. But Victoria was still about 3 hours away, 4 hours away, probably longer. And we got patched through to Canadian Coast Guard. We had chatted to them, and then we had a discussion with Canadian Coast Guard doctor who agreed as well to medevac. And said that he was going to send a rib over for this guy. And I said, well, actually, I think I need to remind you, he weighs about 400 pounds. We aren't going to be able to hoist him down into a rib. So they said, oh, we'll send a helicopter. So they sent a helicopter through around about midnight. And yeah, we had to medevac the guy at midnight. So I was helping the
And
paramedics
they
get
hoisted
him
him
into the
off the
cave.
boat onto the
Yeah,
helicopter.
hoist him. Yeah.
Ah.
Yes. So my most exciting medical emergency was not team related or anything. It was actually, and it's a good lesson to learn for things. Just another thing we did for the WEM handbook was write about pre-existing medical conditions. 95% of problems that happen on expeditions, and that are happening with the military as well, are pre-existing medical conditions. So it's an exacerbation of something that already existed. So interestingly, if you look at that, there was only a 5% chance that there would be a problem on the trip, yet a 95% chance that you'll have a problem with something predictable, so something somebody's had before, or the majority of your incidents happen actually not with a bear or with a kayak in the water, or you know, somebody getting a severe injury. Our biggest risk was carrying the kayaks each day, not the kayaking, but it was carrying loaded kayaks up and down beaches over rocks and things. So we had a very strict routine for doing that, because we're using straps and things and six guys carrying each boat, because if we didn't do that, that's the time you would slip, either break a boat or break an ankle or a femur, or you'd put your hand down and you'd rip your hand open on oyster shells, which were all over those beaches. So, you know, the risk of trauma, although there, was actually very, very small. And the risk of needing to medevac somebody was limited as well. And that was borne out by that incident, that it actually happened on the in full-blown civilization as such.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is because you mitigated it ahead of time. You thought ahead, what are the things that can go wrong? And we're going to have a plan for how we do things that prevent those incidents.
Exactly right. We went through it every stage of the day. We went through our routine and looked at how do we minimize any risk at these points. So we didn't have any gastroenteritis. We didn't have any nausea. We didn't have any dehydration. We didn't have any malnutrition. We didn't have anybody losing weight significantly. The median weight loss during the trip was 5 kilograms. So very, very low. You'd expect it to be, well, you'd expect it on some of these trips, some of the small numbers of kayakers, like some of the solo female kayakers that I've spoken to, I mean, they lost 15, 20 kilos, you know, huge weight loss. Yet body shape changed massively for some of the guys. So we had one guy, 6 kilogram weight loss, 5 inches off his waist.
And then the neck, how does that affect your dry suit too?
Well, interestingly, neck didn't really, what we had is an increase in sort of muscle bulk around the torso, not a massive increase in neck size, but just a significant change in body shape and loss of body fat with an increase in muscle. And interestingly, very few people lost in terms of muscle bulk in their legs.
That is interesting, because you figure you're doing mostly upper body.
But again, it goes back to a lot of it was the carrying equipment. We were constantly carrying heavy bits of equipment up and down the beach all day long, at the start of the day and at the finish of the day.
So is this going to change how you work? Is this going to change how you approach your professional career and patients? And
So professional changes, certainly a lot more objective and looking at laying down boundaries and accepting what you can do in terms of both individual patients and the system. It was very interesting to visit some of the medical establishments in British Columbia. And at one point we had a US doctor paddling with us, and it was very interesting just chatting, very much like at a conference. You realize that the problems that we experience are universal, whether they be funding, interactions with patients, litigation, whatever it is, it's everybody's experiencing that problem. And it's just given a slightly different spin in terms of what country you're in. But certainly I've got more patience since I've come back. I'm calmer. I'm saying these things. I have had some feedback that is the case.
I'll say that differently.
I feel calmer. I feel more in control. I feel more boundaried in what I'm doing.
Right.
So yes, nobody can correct me if I say it that way, can they?
No. No.
And yeah, the
Would
so
you go
the
again?
personal and professional changes. Yes, definitely. Would I go again? Yes, definitely. I would. Going back to the earlier part about the inertia, the logistical planning and the inertia involved around such a big and complex group, I would be wary of that. I think a lot of that had to do with the medical requirements and looking at the fact that a lot of the trip was unknown. I think if you're doing a well-trodden trip, then I think that might be slightly different because a lot of the groundwork will have already been done. I think I'm guilty of being a pedant and almost wanting to over mitigate the risk involved with things and that level of responsibility that you take as the medic and that you almost want to remove as much risk as possible, which is exhausting and it's a law of diminishing returns. You get to the point where you're thinking you're planning for minutiae and things which I did. I mean, if you look at some of the elective kit that I'd taken with us, I mean, there were catheters, equipment that, 2 suture packs, enough there to do intra-articular or muscular injections of steroid and stuff if I had to, things like that where you think about it and you think that was probably overdoing it. But you just hate to be in a situation where if you could have done something and didn't have it. But that would improve with experience. The usually the person to benchmark yourself of, if you think, do I really need to take this? It's speak to Joe Rolls and say, Joe, do I really need to bring this? He's the minimalist. He comes from a similar SF background, and he just goes, no, you don't need that. Don't take it.
You don't need
Because
it.
if that person needs that, you need
I
a
need him to
medevac.
come
Then
go
yeah,
over my whole
but
kit.
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He's he's.
Yep.
He's the other extreme of my head. He's the minimalist version of my cluttered head.
Of you. That's all right. It's, somewhere in the middle we meet.
Yes. Yeah.
And they both work. And they both work. People come back from expedition safe.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
any
I completely agree. And
particular.
it's about the level of risk you're willing to carry. Yeah. The level of risk that you're willing to
Absolutely.
take as an individual. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And then any, I know we've talked about several of them, but are there any lessons that we haven't touched on that you feel you learned that you would want to share with the team embarking on a similar expedition? Or any words of advice, hey, make sure everybody does this or has this or. All in all, it was an incredibly successful mission. And so.
It was, and we yeah, it's always that saying, isn't it? The more I plan and the more I practice, the luckier I get. I've used the same template to look at other trips on behalf of people, and I think I've sort of come to there isn't a single bit of advice you can give, but there is a timeline that you can go through to make sure you don't slip up. And the main way is look at analyze the first thing you do is analyze the expedition. Look at what you're doing, look at the requirements physically, look at the environment, look at the risks, and look at extraction problems as a result of that. Look at the nutritional requirements, look at the hydration, look at the kit involved. Next thing you do is look at the participants. By analyzing the expedition, you've already established the requirements for that. So then what you're doing is you're taking the participants and looking, do they match physically and psychologically, do they fit the requirements for this expedition because they're going to have to do the following in this environment. So can they carry that amount of equipment? Can they sustain that length of time there? Will they get on okay in this environment? So you're looking at their physical and psychological characteristics and thinking, okay, do they match that? Then that information, then you need to look at your own objectives, your own requirements, your own reasoning for going on it. Do you fit what they need? Do you have the skills that are needed? Do you have the ability to use the equipment that you're looking at bringing? And you take all of that information, and that informs what equipment you bring. And then you might have to pare that down, because you might come up with a brilliant list, and then you suddenly find that actually only 50% of that, because of weight and volume, will fit. Or there's no point in bringing X, because the temperature is below this, or the temperature is above this, therefore that will inactivate that drug. There's no point in bringing it. Or we're going to have to think out some other way around this. So there's a sort of a sequence. There's no, unfortunately, there's, you know, no wonderful bit of advice to say, you know, always bring a such and such. You're going to have to analyze it in that way and be brutally honest. That probably is the only bit of advice. Be brutally honest with yourself. Because if you're not, you know, you're going to find yourself in trouble, because if your responsibility is to look after other people, but you're going there because you're severely psychologically damaged and burnt out, that isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to end up being the casualty or the reason the expedition fails. So yes, be honest with about yourself and your own capabilities. But if you go through that, analyze the expedition, analyze the participants, analyze yourself, that will inform you what to bring and what to do, whether that what to bring is actually yourself, because it may be the conclusion you look at by asking the thing that is, no, I shouldn't be going on this. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yep. Yep. And I cannot wait to hear this presentation at the World Extreme Medicine Expo in Edinburgh.
Well, there'll be lots of pretty pictures, lots of videos, and we'll be doing workshops on the logistical planning and medical planning documents for the nice pictures for the expedition, and then the nerdy stuff for people like me who like to do lots of planning.
Planning prevents a lot of suffering.
Yeah, well done for not saying that out loud.
And so you've we all know it.
Yes.
So, I mean, Barry, you've just had an extraordinary career and continue to have an extraordinary career. And there are a lot of medical providers who would like to get into more extreme medicine and expedition-based practices and projects. A lot of us have anchor jobs, and then we do these expeditions because, like we discussed earlier, they don't always pay as well. But how would you advise like a young medic or doctor who looks at this adventure and says, oh, I want to be able to do that? Like, how do I get myself in the situation where I can be the expedition doctor on a kayak mission like this?
It's a brilliant question. And it's one that we hear a lot from people, is how do you do this in a safe way? And how do you do it in such a way that you're not taken advantage of? One of the reasons why we are, you know, we have organizations like WEM, and we have a family sort of network, is to give people advice about exactly this, because you will find that most people within the WEM family have been involved. If you're thinking of getting involved with a race, or if you're thinking of getting involved in a trip or an expedition, invariably, if you ask people within the WEM network, they will tell you that they are a good network to get, that they're a good expedition planner team or event organizer to get involved with, or they're not. The second thing is looking at the liability side of it. And one of the reasons we're looking at medical planning documents and logistical documents is, one of the things I was very surprised about is there are very clearly laid down requirements for indemnity and insurance requirements for medics on trips. And if we can establish an acceptable format to present that in a way that insurers have to accept it. That will mean that the risk to event organizers is very clear. And if they do not provide a paramedic, medic, whatever, if they do not provide a person working at that level, then they will not be meeting their insurance requirements. And therefore, their insurance for the event that they've put a lot of money into organizing may be invalid. And one medevac in that situation could be, or one badly organized medevac could be very costly for them. So they may start to see the advantage of actually recruiting and remunerating medics appropriately for the work and the risk that they take. So if somebody can do that on their own as an inexperienced medic, then we need to find out who they are, because the quality of the people involved with WEM, and we're still struggling to answer that question. And I think if we can take steps towards recognition of risk and recognition of requirements for indemnity, then we're getting closer to answering that question about allowing younger doctors and younger nurses and younger paramedics to do things and get involved in trips in a safe way and in a way in which they're not taken advantage of.
Brilliant. Any other parting thoughts?
No, other than it's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in November.
Thank you, and I can't wait to see you too. And I want to say thank you so much to Dr. Barry McKenna for being my guest today. And thank you again to everyone listening. I'm Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and it is my pleasure to share these extreme medicine adventures with you. If you're listening with us, you too are an extreme medic, and we welcome you to the World Extreme Medicine family. Stay safe out there and always keep pushing your boundaries.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.